Hey, are we live yet? Are we live yet? Testing. 1, 2, 3. Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's online podcast with your host, Jan Irvin. Here we investigate the religious, the mysterious, the entheogenic, the shamanic, and the Gnostic with the small g. Haven't heard it someplace else, you'll likely hear it here. So sit back and relax. Take a trip through time and a journey through your mind as we investigate the ancient mysteries. Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 12. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. This episode may blow your mind. I know it did mine. It was so good that at 2.5 hours, I decided not to split it in half and make it into 2 episodes, so it's all right here. Today's guest was awarded the Czech Republic's highest honor in 2007 for lifetime achievements and advancements in research and science not yet recognized by society. For you diehard psychonauts out there, my guest hardly needs introduction. He comes with such titles as the world's leading LSD researcher, with over 3,000 human clinical studies under his belt, not to mention a wealth of his own personal experience with altered states of consciousness, with and without drugs. And just how deep does the rabbit hole go? What if nearly everything you were ever taught about LSD was buried in untruths and mass hysteria? What if LSD and other psychedelics really do unlock varying degrees of consciousness and spirituality and have amazing potential at curing varying degrees of mental illness? What if, instead of giving patients Prozac and Zoloft so that they can forget about and are incapable of dealing with their spiritual and mental issues, we could actually guide them through an experience so profound that many would no longer need any continued prescription drugs at all? And of course, today, the sound of that sends shivers down the spines of many CEOs of today's pharmaceutical companies. What if you understood and applied set and setting? The unfoldment process of the experience is probably one of the most misunderstood concepts I've ever come across in my years of research. Today's guest, Dr. Stanislav Grof, is author of many books and co-founder of the newest field in psychology, which is transpersonal psychology, and he's here to pry your third eye wide open. I had a strong consciousness shift when I recorded this interview, and I pass that on to you if you remain attentive. Donations this week, I thank Greg for his donation. I really appreciate it. Donations are what keep this show going. I seriously don't like to ask for donations each week, but this show and Gnostic Media and the videos and books is what I do. And when you donate or buy one of the books or the DVD, you're showing your support for the continuation of this work. My last 2 jobs left me unpaid for over $13,000 last year, and I went through 1 layoff and another company that went out of business, leaving me unemployed and just about homeless. And so twice in 1 year with a family to support was a little bit stressful and left me a little discontented with corporate America. So I decided to see if I could support my family and continue my passion, which is writing and research and doing the videos and the continuation of Gnostic Media, rather than doing something that I get little or no reward from. So here I am. And I really thank every one of you who has donated or bought one of the books or the DVD on the website. It really does mean a lot to me. And I wanted to mention that my newest book, The Holy Mushroom, Evidence of Mushrooms in Judeo-Christianity, I do still have 9 copies of that available in the numbered and signed, if you would still like one of those. Hopefully that will become a collector just because of the content material. Also, my first book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, actually went out of print as of yesterday. And the new second edition is submitted for print. And on the store page on the website, I've also put up a pre-order for the second edition of Astrotheology and Shamanism, my first book that I wrote with Andrew Rutaji. And what I will be doing is shipping the first 25 orders of that with a free copy of the DVD, The Pharmacratic Inquisition. And the DVD is the companion for the book, so you'll get the whole set together with that. Let's see. I don't think I'm going to have, or I don't think there were any microphone issues that were in this recording. It wasn't done with the new mic sent from David, but it was done on a slightly better mic, not as good as the one I'm on right now, but not too shabby. Upcoming shows include Dr. Roland Griffiths from Johns Hopkins University on psilocybin research, Chris Bennett on cannabis in religion. He's the author of Green Gold, The Tree of Life, and Sex, Drugs, Violence, and the Bible. And I may stick that John Loftus interview on the end of his interview since they're both shorter shows or shorter interviews. I also have Stephen Booner coming up. Haven't recorded that one yet still. I may put that one on for the 19th or for the 26th. I haven't decided for sure yet. Let's see. Also coming up is Professor Michael Winkelman from Arizona State discussing his new book, Supernatural is Natural, A Biocultural Approach to Religion. And Dr. Dennis McKenna, who will be discussing ethnobotany and his own research. Judith Ann Brown, who is the daughter of the Dead Sea Scrolls scholar and author of The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, John Marco Allegro. And she will be on to discuss the reprinting of The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross this year, as well as her own research in her book, John Marco Allegro, The Maverick of the Dead Sea Scrolls. I will also be having on Ernest Werner, who is a former minister of 50 years and former member of the Cornell University chaplain staff, who has written a book called The Rod of Jesse, Questioning the Historicity of Jesus. That is a book that I highly recommend if you haven't checked it out already. I'm also working on getting a few other guests on the show. I hope to get Dr. E.C. Krupp on from the Griffith Observatory in Los Angeles, who is an expert in archaeoastronomy. And he is not confirmed on that yet, but hopefully I'll hear back from him this week on a yes or no. And if you would like to contact me directly, feel free to contact me at contact@gnosticmedia.com. And you can also go to my website at www.gnosticmedia.com. That's GNOSTICmedia.com. And you can check out some of the other websites and projects I have up there, like Hemp for Fuel or the She Who Remembers audio archives and things like that. And so without further ado, here is my interview with Dr. Stanislav Grof. Once again, be prepared to have your mind blown. Your third eye will hopefully come out of this interview squeegeed quite clean. Enjoy the show. Are you ready to get going?
Yes, anytime you are.
Okay. Well, would you like to start off by discussing your educational background?
Well, I was born and got my education in Prague, called the Czechoslovakia at the time. It's now Czech Republic. I studied medical school. I got a medical degree from Charles University in Prague. And then later, I got a PhD from the Czechoslovakian Academy of Sciences.
And how did you get started in your present areas of research? How did you get into what you do?
Well, I went to study medicine and psychiatry specifically to become a psychoanalyst. I got very excited in my post-adolescent years by Freud. A friend of mine gave me introductory lectures of psychoanalysis. I started reading it in the evening. I couldn't go to sleep. I sort of read through the night. And within about 2 days, I decided to enroll in the medical school, specifically to become a psychoanalyst. This was at a time when I had completely different plans. I liked to draw and paint, and I wanted to work in animated movies. And I had my introductory interview with somebody who was a very famous Czech artist who was known for animated movies. He got a lot of the gold medals in Cannes and other places, and he accepted me. But after reading Freud, I just really practically overnight changed my mind and went in that other direction.
And do you think you made the right decision today?
I think I do, yes. there was a time when I didn't think so, when I was getting so discouraged with psychoanalysis. You know, initially it was not the theory of psychoanalysis, but it was when I became aware of how narrow the indication range is. People have to meet very specific criteria to be considered good candidates. And then also the amount of time. You know, my psychoanalysis, the training psychoanalysis was 3 times a week for seven years. A lot of money, a lot of time. And, you know, I loved every minute of my psychoanalysis. I like to play with my dreams and finding that every slip of the tongue, you know, was a slip of my tongue was had some kind of a profound meaning. And I was very excited about the dream symbolism and so on. But if you ask me, you know, did it change you? I would say, well, you know, I changed, but in 7 years you changed anyway. And I didn't have a sense that there was a really convincing relationship between what I was doing with my dreams and any of the changes that happened during the 7 years. So I got to the point where I was really disappointed with psychoanalysis in terms of a clinical tool. At the time when I was excited about the the theoretical interpretations. And just at the time when I was experiencing this crisis, where I was really questioning whether it was the right decision for me to go and become a psychiatrist, we got a supply of LSD from Sandoz, from the Swiss company that produced LSD after Dr. Hoffman discovered it. And with that came a letter which said this was a very fascinating experimental new substance, and the powerful psychoactive effects of this substance were discovered by Dr. Hoffman, who actually accidentally intoxicated himself when he was synthesizing it. And the letter also said that Dr. Stoll, who was the son of Dr. Hoffman's boss, who was a psychiatrist in Zurich, did a pilot study, and that they felt that this substance might be very interesting in psychiatry and psychology. And they were basically asking us if we would like to work with it and give them some feedback as to what we think about the substance and how it could be used, or if it could be used in some way in psychology and psychiatry. And in their letter, they gave two basic tips. One was that they felt there was a deep relationship between what people experience under the influence of LSD and what you see in naturally occurring episodes of non-ordinary states that we call psychosis, and that there would be a possibility to induce this experimental psychosis or model psychosis in otherwise quote-unquote normal people, and do all kinds of tests you know, psychological tests, electrophysiological tests, biochemical tests, and so on, before, during, and after, and you would get insight as to what's happening biochemically, biologically in the organism when the mental functioning is so profoundly changed, and that this could bring some kind of new insights into psychosis, particularly schizophrenia, and that it might lead to discovery of a kind of test tube solution for schizophrenia. You know, if we could identify the substance that was responsible for these changes, we could also find an antidote for that. We could have a kind of a chemical solution for schizophrenia, which of course would be kind of holy grail of psychiatry. So it was very exciting. Every time you have a model in science, you know, it's an extremely useful thing. But then there was another tip that came in this letter, which kind of became my destiny or karma, whatever you want to call it. They said that they also feel that this could be a kind of unconventional educational tool that psychiatrists, psychologists, students, nurses, and so on could have a session and spend several hours in a world that would be very similar to the world of their patients, and as a result of it would be able to understand them better, communicate more effectively, and hopefully be more successful in treating them. So I was in that state where I was quite disenchanted with psychoanalysis, and so this was very exciting for me. I wouldn't have missed it for anything in the world, and I became one of the early volunteers, and I had a session that really sent me personally and professionally in a completely, completely different direction. I told you before that I would find it difficult to say whether psychoanalysis changed me in any significant way, but I certainly can tell it with certainty about this one session. I know that I was one kind of person in the morning and somebody else, you know, in the evening, and no doubt in my mind that it was a result of the experiences that I had. I basically had a very profound mystical experience, an experience of cosmic unity, oneness with the universe, and so on. And the effect on me was so powerful that basically in the last 50 years I have really done very little that would not be related in one way or another to these non-ordinary states of consciousness. So it became my vocation, my profession, my passion, in a way. So this, in a nutshell, is the beginning. You know.
I was just going to say, I've had similar profound changes on my own life occur from similar experiences, so I understand exactly where you're coming from. You were recently awarded a very high honor by the president of the Czech Republic. Could you discuss that?
Yes, it actually came as a very, very big surprise to me. The former Czech president Václav Havel and his wife started a foundation that's giving annually awards, actually given on Václav Havel's birthday. So every year they choose one person who is given this this award. And basically, if you read the description of it, it's being given to people who do some pioneering work that might bring some fruit in the future, although current generation might not really understand it or appreciate it. So this is given to work where they themselves feel that there is some new direction that's being shown. The series started with Carl Pribram as a laureate, who's a, you know, famous brain researcher who developed the holographic model of the brain. So I, you know, I was very, very surprised, particularly because of the very controversial nature of psychedelic research, that that Václav Havel had the courage, you know, to give the award for something that you know, has such a problematic public image. So we had an extraordinary time, Christina and myself, and Nathaniel and Deborah, you know, the son and daughter-in-law. They went with us, and this was just a very, very beautiful ceremony in a church that is now turned into a spiritual center in Prague that the Havels are running. And we had just also, you know, amazing, amazing personal time with them. For me, it was extremely, extremely precious, extremely valuable, because I have admired Václav Havel for years. You know, he is basically an artist. He is a playwright who was a dissident during the communist era, in and out of prison. And when the revolution happened in Prague, he was one of the major figures in it, and he basically was asked by people to become president. He didn't want to be president. People say that he was sort of taken to the Prague castle kicking and screaming. He would have much rather continued doing what he loved to do, which is write plays. But at the same time, during the time when he was president, he really showed an unbelievable statesman vision. One of the things that he did, the first things he did, is to invite His Holiness the Dalai Lama and spend 3 days with him. And the real spiritual vision for the world. He did a lot of lectures in the United States, and I think all over the world he was very, very appreciated. He was not a great politician, you know, because great vision doesn't always go hand in hand with practical politics. It also, one of the problems was he wanted to stop, for example, production of weapons in Czechoslovakia. You know, it would be necessary to have neighbors who are on the same level, or partners who are on the same level.
Yes.
So he got into, you know, a lot of troubles because of the practical consequences of some of the his decisions, including bringing the Dalai Lama and acknowledging him as the head of Tibet without worrying what it's going to do to business with China and so on. So it was, you know, in a nutshell, it was just an amazing experience, and I feel very, very honored by that.
You describe in your book, LSD Psychotherapy, that LSD is a tool much like a knife. Would you discuss your analogy?
Yes, you know, there has been tremendous controversy about LSD. Some people sort of thinking about it as a panacea, as, you know, a therapeutic tool of incredible value and power and usefulness. And on the other side, there are people who see it as a kind of a devil's substance, you know, that people go into psychotic breaks and have flashbacks and so on. And it was also considered by the military of the whole world and by the secret police as a tool, as a chemical weapon, something that could be added to the water supply of cities, so that could be used as aerosol to paralyze the, you know, the army, or put it in drinks of foreign diplomats to compromise them and so on. And so when we had these discussions in psychiatric conferences, at one point Humphrey Osmond said, you know, we are dealing with a tool, a very powerful tool, and there's no intrinsic positive or negative value in it. It depends on who is using it for what kind of purposes. This is what we call set and setting. And he gave that example of a knife. If you can imagine a discussion about a knife, you know, is this a very dangerous and evil instrument, or is it a very useful instrument? And you would have a discussion where, on the one hand, you would have a surgeon, you know, a general who would say, be saying, well, if you have the proper training, you could do great things with the knife. And then you would have a chief of New York police who would be talking about it as an instrument that killed a lot of people in the back alleys of New York City. And you would have a housewife who would be thinking about it as a tool for cutting vegetables and salami. And you would have an artist who would think primarily about using it to do some wonderful wood carvings and so on. Now, if this were happening, we would understand that it's not the knife that's to blame, you know, or to extol, that we are talking about the human uses, different human uses. And you can say the same about LSD. I mean, if you have proper training and you do it with responsibility, you can do amazing things with it. We have seen changes in chronic alcoholics, chronic drug addicts. We had an amazing program with people dying of cancer where it helped them with pain, even pain that sometimes could not be controlled by narcotics, and not just for the time of the experience, but sometimes for several weeks the pain would disappear or be significantly alleviated. But it also took away the fear of death and transformed the experience of dying. That was really the most moving program that we had in at the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center. So it is an amazing therapeutic tool if it is properly used. Now we have a different story if you know somebody brings a handful of sugar cubes laced with LSD into a party in Berkeley and throws it into a bowl of fruit punch, and people are drinking it and they don't know what they are taking, you know, or if it's used in the context of raves where people meet somewhere in the street, you know, knowing that they are doing something illegal, that police can come. Those are miserable settings. Or if you have people who think about it as primarily as something that could hurt other people, like the military or the secret police using it for brainwashing and you know, interrogation and so on. So it is a tool. It's an amazing tool, and I feel, you know, a lot of awe and respect to what it can do on both sides. Used properly, you know, with some responsibility and some sort of ethical values, and what it can do if it's used in an ignorant way, or you know, particularly if it's used in a malicious way. It's a powerful tool. I also made another comparison, which was coming from my appreciation for its positive value, when I compared it to a telescope or a microscope, that when you take LSD, it is basically a catalyst that sort of activates some really deep realms in your unconscious that normally is not available, but has a very powerful influence on it. So the contents of this deep unconscious will surface, and you can study, you can learn enormous things about the human psyche, you know, how these deep levels of the unconscious influence the way we feel about ourselves, the way we perceive the world, the way we behave, and so on. So it opens for study certain areas which are normally not observable. And this is, of course, the case of microscope, where you can discover, you know, dimensions of the world that you were not aware of, that whole micro world of bacteria, for example, and so on. And the same with the telescope, where you can discover, you know, millions of galaxies, something that we normally are not aware of or cannot observe. So I really believe that psychedelics could be, properly used, responsibly used, could be as useful for psychiatric psychology as the microscope is for biology or medicine, or the telescope is for astronomy.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that was something that I had read in your books and had thought to mention, but I'm glad that you brought it up on your own. What would you say are the dangers of LSD?
Well, the dangers are, you know, that it opens up very, very, opens the psyche on a very, very deep level, which on one hand is a tremendous opportunity for healing, for transformation. On the other hand, if it is not properly handled, it can be very destructive. You know, I have seen people who had taken LSD under very poor circumstances, and in the middle of the session were given tranquilizers, so that the material that was causing the quote-unquote bad trip could not be really properly processed and integrated. And their whole psyche got frozen in that really difficult place. And then they were put on maintenance dosages, you know, preventing the resolution of what was trying to emerge. And 10, 20 years later, they were still in a psychiatric ward. And when they reduced the dosage, the experience it was trying to continue, and the conclusion was that they're still sick and need more medication. On the positive side, we have met over the years people who got stuck in bad places with psychedelics, and we were able to help them. In Maryland, where we had the license to use LSD, we actually scheduled sessions, you know, supervised sessions, and help them to complete what was trying to happen in the bad trip. And we also had many of these people over the years in what we call holotropic breathwork, which is a powerful non-drug method using breathing, music, and a certain kind of bodywork. It's something that Christina and I developed when we were at the SLN Institute in Big Sur, and it's a method where powerful experiences, quite similar to psychedelic experiences, can be induced just by breathing, music, and bodywork. And so we had people who came who were stuck in a place as a result of a session they had 10, 15, 20 years ago, and they were able to complete it just using breathing and music and the bodywork.
It's very interesting that you brought that up. Back in, I suppose it was 2003, I had done an ayahuasca session, which during the session, it sort of went bad. I kind of ended up in a bad trip that I tried to stop the session. And then about 3 months later, I went back and did another ayahuasca session where I actually completed the part where I had stopped and figured out what had gone wrong and was able to resolve the issue internally.
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, the current practice, professional practice, if somebody comes with either during the bad trip or afterwards with some kind of unfinished business, that's treated by suppressive therapy, by tranquilizers, rather than the uncovering, which means, you know, continuing some experiential work so that you can finish what was trying to happen. So I think we have a long way to go before we can really use sort of work with these states effectively on a large scale. You know, there are groups of professionals now who have done some work with psychedelics, who are aware of it and know this, but it is not really known in the academic circle, so these states are not handled very effectively.
Is LSD addictive?
No, it's not addictive, physiologically addictive, in the same way as heroin or cocaine can be, and so on, where you have to increase the dosage, for example, to get the same effect. If you continue using it, you get to the point where you cannot stop it because you would be experiencing some very unpleasant withdrawal symptoms, or after a longer period of time, you kind of hit bottom and so on. So this is not the pattern for LSD. There are people who can take a lot of LSD because they know they like the experiences, but there are people who get sort of addicted in the same way to television or to computer or to some kind of computer games. So it's not physiologically addictive, and it's very biologically, it's very, very safe. It's really the problem of the set and setting, which is really the most critical there.
What is a flashback?
Well, I already talked about it some, that the flashback happens when you have an experience and the experience remains poorly resolved. We emphasize, for example, when people do psychedelics or when we do the breathwork, you do it with your eyes closed so that you really pay attention to what emerges. You're experience it. You express it, and so on. If you don't do that, for example, people who do it in raves and so on, where they have to pay attention to the external environment rather than their inner world, or people who take it and they drive or do some crazy thing like that, they have to keep being focused on the outside while the unconscious material, very deep unconscious material, is becoming available. And so they can end up with a session that's very poorly resolved, and if it doesn't find a closure at all, you get what we call prolonged reaction. But it can also happen that there is a very precarious closure, and at some later date, when people, for example, have a flu, or they are exhausted, they didn't sleep enough, or they smoke a joint, marijuana joint, something that further lowers the defenses, that this material that has not been really properly processed in the session starts emerging. And because people recognize the similarity of that material with what they experienced in the session, they would call it a flashback, where it's really still continuation of the same experience that remained unfinished. So again, the way we would work with flashbacks is you do more experiential work. You take people into the experience rather than trying to suppress it. And you're trying to find some natural resolution of that.
Well, you've talked about some of the benefits of LSD and psychedelics. Are there any others that you didn't mention?
Any benefits?
Yes. Any other benefits?
Well,
that you...
yeah, there are. We already talked about the LSD as a therapeutic tool. Now, another thing that we have explored quite extensively over the years is the effect on creativity, primarily painting, because for many people the experiences are so visual. So we had many, many artists in our programs, and you could see the tremendous change that happens in their style and the content of what they are painting as a result of this. And people who are not artists and who have the experiences they frequently come back with the sense that they have a whole new understanding of modern art, for example, Cubism or Impressionism or Abstractionism and so on, because they realize that there are certain states in which you can see the world the way it was portrayed by artists of these different different movements. But it's not limited to art. It can also tremendously facilitate, catalyze scientific thinking or creativity of some other kind. So, for example, Francis Crick, who discovered the formula of DNA, said that, you know, it happened under the influence of LSD, that LSD enormously catalyzed his ability to break through the barriers that were standing in the way. There's a wonderful book by Willis Harman, which is called Higher Creativity, and it's full of examples where people had major breakthroughs, artistic and scientific, when they were in one type or another of a non-ordinary state. You know, working for a long time on a problem, not being able to resolve it in the ordinary state of consciousness, and then when a non-ordinary state comes, then the solution happens. The most famous example is Friedrich Kekulé, who discovered the formula for what's called benzene, which is a substance where the chemical formula is basically a hexagon, which has carbon and hydrogen on each of the points. And he worked with the substance, but he knew how many carbons, how many hydrogens were there, but he couldn't figure out how they were arranged. And then when he was very tired and he was in what we call a hypnagogic state, almost asleep, he was watching fire and got kind of hypnotized by it. Suddenly an image came to him of a snake that was biting its tail. And he realized that was the formula. That was the formula for benzene, that you have to close the chain and create a ring. So Willis Harman gives, you know, large number of instances. He gives an instance of a man who grew up in an Indian village, and he had visions of a village goddess who was teaching him mathematics. And then he came to Oxford, and he was solving problems that the Oxford mathematicians couldn't solve. Einstein had the idea for theory of relativity in a non-ordinary state, and the major insights came to him actually in a kinesthetic experience. He felt it in his body. And then he also gives examples of artists where, for example, Puccini said, I didn't write Madame Butterfly, it was God who created it. I was just holding the pen. Basically, he was channeling that. Mozart said that whole symphonies appeared in his head in the finished form that he just had to put in on paper. So there is tremendous and a possibility of very unusual creativity that can happen in these states. Again, if there are properly structured, if these experiments are done responsibly. And there is another important area, which is, of course, a significant part of the spectrum of the psychedelic experience would be experiences that basically are mystical, that are numinous, spiritual, and so on. So there's enormous possibility of studying psychology of religion and the psychopathology of religion as well, and also a tremendous opportunity for people to actually have a mystical experience. A close friend of mine, Walter Pankey, who is not alive anymore, he drowned in the Atlantic during scuba diving, but he conducted a very famous experiment at Harvard in the Harvard Chapel on Good Friday. It's called Good Friday Experiment, where he gave psilocybin, which is a substance similar to LSD, to a group of theology students during the divine service. And half of the students got niacin, a placebo, which is basically a vitamin, and was able to show that the people who got psilocybin had mystical experiences that were indistinguishable from mystical experiences that are described in the spiritual literature of all ages, really. And we had a training program at the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center where professionals could come and have up to 3 high-dose sessions for learning purposes. So psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, and so on. But we also had number of priests who were doing pastoral counseling. And we had number of instances where people in the clergy had a mystical spiritual experience for the first time in their life. And they suddenly understood what they were reading about and talking about. And we had actually some priests there who ended up in priesthood for all kinds of wrong kind of reasons. Like I remember one who came as an immigrant from Russia and was offered a scholarship in Canada. And so he became a priest, but then he became exposed to science, and he came to the conclusion that, you know, religion is really a nonsense, it's a superstition. But since he already was in that profession, he just continued to give sermons and so on. And he had a very powerful mystical experience in our program and felt, you know, extremely validated that that he was not really dedicating to his life to something that's a complete complete delusion or illusion. So that's another very, very important area, the opening this realm of spiritual experience for people. I think we have covered probably most of it.
What, who or what type of people use LSD?
What kinds of people?
Yes.
You know, there is a group of people who use it very, or have used it very seriously and responsibly. You know, those would be people like Aldous Huxley, for example, you know, serious philosopher, Houston Smith, religious scholar, and so on. People who really were taking it for philosophical insights, for spiritual insights, they considered it their spiritual path, and so on. I have known many psychologists, psychiatrists, who have done it partially as for... Hello?
Yes, I'm here. Do you hear me?
Yeah, I got some hum there.
Yeah, I'm hearing it too.
So these people were using it for spiritual insight, for scientific insight, and so on. And there were psychologists, psychiatrists doing it for professional reasons, but many of them ended up in a kind of spiritual quest when they started from a professional interest. So those are people who do it seriously, who are concerned about the set and the setting. They do a lot of reading around it, and they see it as a very serious kind of a spiritual path or journey of spiritual philosophical discovery. And then, of course, there are a lot of people who take it for kicks, you know, in a very irresponsible way. A lot of the young people take it because it's an adventure. Many of them are actually supported, you know, in drug taking by the fact that it's illegal. It's always exciting for young people to do something that's illegal. There's that whole group that doesn't usually care about set and setting. They do it under circumstances that really increase the risk tremendously and reduce the potential benefit. And you know, I already mentioned that the worst group of people, which is the military and the secret services and so on, who are thinking about it as basically a weapon.
What percentage of people would you say, or are there any studies that show risk of seizures and things like that, other forms of trauma?
Well, there was the most interesting encompassing study was a study done by Dr. Sidney Cohen in the early years of LSD research, when we really didn't know very much about LSD and psilocybin and other substances. But it was mostly done in a medical setting where it was understood that people who take it have to be supervised. There have to be at least one person with them all the time. You want to keep them overnight. You want to see them the next day, be sure that everything's okay. So there was not a really profound knowledge of experience, but some kind of, you know, basic responsibility about how these experiments were done. And he sent out questionnaires to a number of people who were doing this early research and collected data about 25,000 sessions and showed that the risk under these circumstances was really minimal, much lower than it was the case with other procedures that were routinely used in psychiatry, like in, you know, insulin therapy or electroconvulsive therapy and so on. There was just a small fraction of these people who made a suicidal attempt after the session. So basically the risks were very, very, very minimal and well worth the potential usefulness. But then of course, you know, when people are taking it under uncontrolled circumstances, then of course the situation is different. You know, the possibility of poorly resolved sessions, flashbacks and so on is much higher. And also the fact that things can happen during these sessions. If people are not supervised, that they sit in open windows or they, you know, they drive cars and so on. So if something like this happens, you know, somebody jumps out of the window, that it doesn't say anything about LSD. That says something about the people who either were doing it themselves or people who were around it. So those kinds of things simply would not happen if it were done in the responsible way in the first place.
Would you say that that's...
And if it's done...
I was just going to say, would you say that that's related to how our society treats these things in general as compared to, say, maybe a shamanic society?
Well, you know, in these ancient societies, in pre-industrial native societies, this was seen as very serious business. This was done for either healing purposes or for spiritual purposes. It was done in a kind of a sacred context. These substances were taken very seriously. They were considered sacraments. Whereas our, you know, our society did something very different. Although it started at least in a therapeutic setting, you know, in psychiatric hospitals and so on, then it got into the streets and ended up in a completely uncontrolled situation, besides some of the you know, the categories of people who did it privately and very responsibly, but the majority of the culture was really using it in a very ignorant way.
Like Ken Kesey and Timothy Leary's adventures, so to speak.
Well, you know, problem with Tim Leary was that he was a proselytizer. He was basically trying to sell psychedelics. So he was talking one-sidedly about all the great things that people can expect. He was talking about trillions of cells of your body will be singing the song of ecstasy and liberation. It didn't really adequately warn people that before you go to heaven, you can also go to hell, or you can go to hell to get to heaven. And so, you know, thousands of people were taking it very poorly prepared on the basis of this very casual but very charismatic advice, turn on, tune in, drop out, and so on.
In your books, you mention telepathy and other strange phenomenon with LSD and other psychedelic substances. Could you discuss this?
What was that?
I said in your books, you discuss telepathy and other strange occurrences with LSD and other psychedelic substances. Could you discuss those experiences?
Yes, there's just an enormous number of psychic phenomena in general that these non-ordinary states tremendously facilitate. Of course, those things can happen in everyday life, you know, but the incidence of psychic phenomena increases exponentially. And it goes beyond the categories which are studied in parapsychology, which is like telepathy, psychometry, you know, out-of-body experiences, and so on. For example, you can have experiences of very, very convincing identification with animals, where you actually become those animals. Your body image becomes that of those animals. You look at the world through the eyes of those animals. You have the all the sensations associated with the life of these animals, and enormous amount of new information comes that you did not have, that had not come through the ordinary channel, and much of this information could not come by reading something or by watching a television or a movie, because the program like Nova would show you what the eagle looks like or what the eagle sounds like, but there's no way it can give you the information what an eagle feels like. And when you in these non-ordinary states become an eagle, you suddenly understand how you fly, what you do with your body to work the air currents and so on. You would see the world in a way that corresponds to the optical system of the eagle, which is very different from ours. Or people had identification with dolphins, you know, particularly another friend of mine, John Lilly, who studied dolphins, gave LSD to dolphins and also took LSD with dolphins. And he had the experiences of literally becoming a dolphin and having the experience of the world that a dolphin has, which is very different because, you know, a lot of the information for the dolphin is coming acoustically rather than visually. There's a possibility of having the experience of a bat or an experience of a bee, you know, that perceive the world in a completely different way. And even if you never studied these things, you never had been interested in these things, you can get this enormous amount of this, you know, completely different kind of information. So the psychic capacity really goes beyond what parapsychology studies, because there's this psychic element in a number of different kinds of these experiences that we call transpersonal in psychedelic sessions. I think the best studies that have been done, the most convincing studies, actually come from thanatology, where we have now large number of observations showing that it's possible for a person to be, for example, in a reclining position on an operation table with the eyes closed, in a coma, in a state of clinical death, where it's a cardiac death, but in some instances also brain, these people are brain dead, and their consciousness can get out of the body and they can perceive what's happening in the environment. And sometimes they can actually move to other locations, like go through the walls, and they experience what's happening in other rooms of the same building, or they go through all the ceilings and they go above the hospital and they see the environment. And a very interesting study was done by Ken Ring and co-workers of something that they call MindSight, which is they found out that people who are congenitally blind for organic reasons, when their consciousness gets out of the body under these circumstances, they can see, and for the first time. And not only can they see, but what they see can be consensually validated by other people as being actually there in a more objective, consensual way. So Ken Ring talks about veridical out-of-body experiences, you know, experiences that you can verify that those things that these people perceived were actually happening in a situation where they had no conventional capacity to see.
With your experience and background, would you suggest that these experiences are real or just, I mean, with the studies behind it, it seems that they're real.
Well, I know they're, you know, they're real. Obviously, you cannot find verification for every single experience. But, for example, this group of the out-of-body experiences in near-death situations lends itself, you know, particularly well to these studies. You know, I mean, if a congenitally blind person tells you what the environment of a hospital looks like from a bird's eye view, you know, I mean, what is the probability that something like this could be a fantasy? Or if they can tell you, you know, what happened several hundred miles away, or what happened in the other rooms of the building. But we had similar instances where we could verify certain information they came through these experiences. I give in my book When the Impossible Happens, when I actually collected personal stories and observations describing situations that would be in principle impossible if the universe were the way it's described by materialistic science. This is why it's called When the Impossible Happens. And I described a number of experiences that people got information that they couldn't possibly have, including two experiences where they described situations from other centuries. Once it was from the 17th century in Europe, from the time the beginning of the 30 Years' War, and the second experience was when a person relived episodes from a historical event that happened at the time of Walter Raleigh, during the time of battle between England and Spain. So, you know, obviously these kinds of situations, when it's a past life experience from another century, it's not as easy to verify as these out-of-body experiences where people describe situations in their immediate environment or somewhere in the physical world at present, where we have ways of getting the information and verify to what extent this was accurate. But I have seen enough, and I have verified enough to know that in principle this is possible. although you cannot generalize and say that, you know, it's true for all the experiences where some seemingly psychic elements occur. But it's also very, very incorrect to say that psychic phenomena cannot happen, that they don't exist, which is the judgment, you know, of most of the materialistically educated scientists.
It's fascinating information, and you know, these things are particularly difficult to describe when they happen, and I think they're most typically dismissed as just hallucination by most outside viewers. So it's very interesting to hear from a scientific point of view how often these things actually happen and how verifiable they really are.
Well, for me, you know, this has been a difficult journey because I had a very traditional scientific training, medical training. Now, in addition, I had it at a time when we had a Marxist regime. We were controlled by the Soviet Union. So what we were getting through education was a particularly extreme form of the materialistic worldview, where everything that was considered idealistic was either ridiculed or was censored out. And since I started working with LSD, this was has been a journey of, surprises, major surprises that were coming basically every day. And I had to change my worldview a number of times along the way.
What is the transcendental or transpersonal or what you call cosmic unity experience?
Well, we are talking about several things. You know, there is a category of experiences which I called transpersonal. The usual understanding of the psyche that you find in academic circles is that the psyche is limited to postnatal biography, things that happened to us since the time we were born. Freud talked about the newborn as being tabula rasa, which is something like a clean slate. There's nothing there. So who we become, you know, the whole software of the brain is coming from postnatal events, from infancy, childhood, and later life. And then in academic circles, we have also something called the individual unconscious, described by Freud, which by and large is also a derivative of postnatal biography, things that we repressed, that we forgotten, that we found objectionable, and so on. But there's no recognition, for example, that a birth is an important psychological event, and certainly not anything that preceded birth, you know, such as prenatal life or what's happening. What happened in the life of our ancestors, collective racial memories that Jung is talking about, and so on. So I had to significantly expand this cartography. And the cartography that came out of the psychedelic observations has actually three areas, when this realm of postnatal biography is just the most superficial level. The level of the psyche described by Freud. Joseph Campbell, famous mythologist, you know, put it very succinctly and kind of facetiously. He said that Freud was fishing while sitting on a whale. Joseph Campbell was, very, very Jungian in his orientation. And then I had to add two vast areas to the image of the unconscious. One that I call perinatal, where we have the record of the whole process of biological birth, things that happen to us at different stages of birth. It's all recorded in the unconscious. And then beyond the perinatal realm, there is a realm that we now call transpersonal. And this involves potential for experiences of experiencing ourselves in union with other people, or experience ourselves as other people, experiencing group consciousness, for example, experiencing consciousness of animals, as I just described it, or other life forms in general, transcending time and going to previous centuries, to other countries, to our other cultures, and having experiences from there, sometimes with a sense of personal remembering, and then people talk about this as past life experiences, you know, confirming the whole concept of reincarnation. We don't have just one life, we have a whole chain of life, and under certain circumstances we can get access to certain selected memories from these previous lifetimes. And then another large area of these transpersonal experiences would be experiences that take us into mythological domains. This is what Jung called the archetypal realm of the collective unconscious. So the collective unconscious that Jung described has two aspects. One is the historical collective unconscious, where the whole history of humanity is recorded, like an archive, you know, that becomes available under certain circumstances to all of us in these non-ordinary states. And then the other aspect of the collective unconscious is the archetype of the mythological, where we can have experiences of mythological beings of different cultures, or visiting different mythological realms like heaven or hell or paradises of different cultures and so on. Again, whether or not we studied this, whether or not we have any intellectual knowledge. So this is not something that we learned in our postnatal life, but it's part of this collective unconscious that contains the whole cultural and historical heritage of humanity. So this is what we call transpersonal experiences. And what you refer to as experience of cosmic unity is just one category of these, an important category of these transpersonal experiences, when we have the sense that not just our individual boundaries, but all boundaries dissolved, and we basically experience ourselves as being one with the entire universe, with all of creation, beyond that experience, identification with the divine, with the creative principle itself. So with the creative principle and with the creation, the whole spectrum of creation.
What can you say about your own experiences with these transpersonal and cosmic unity experiences?
Well, I had many, many experiences of non-ordinary states over the years. You know, I've been studying this over 50 years, and it was not just studying what happens to other people, but combining somehow my own deep self-exploration with observation of other people. So I have personally experienced all psychedelic substances that I have worked with before I gave it to other people, and you know, some of these substances repeatedly over the years. And then I had also many experiences that were non-pharmacological, for example, with the holotropic breathwork that Christina and I have developed using breathing and music. We also had experiences with a number of spiritual systems. We have done spiritual retreats with Jack Kornfield, who's very wonderful and accomplished, both psychologist and Buddhist monk, Buddhist teacher. So we do these retreats in different centers. We did it in Yucca Valley. Our next one will be in, I think it's October next year, in at the Omega Center in Rhinebeck in New York State, where we combine Buddhist Vipassana meditation with the breath work. And so we both have done quite a bit of Vipassana Buddhist meditation, also Zen Buddhist meditation. And we spent significant time around Swami Muktananda, who was a Siddha Yogi, who was head of the Siddha Yoga lineage. So we have done many, it's called intensives with him, and meditation that was the Siddha Yoga meditation. Both of us received what's called Shaktipat from Muktananda. So, you know, I have very rich history of these non-ordinary experiences, parallel, kind of interspersed with my everyday experience of the world.
So these things don't just seem like drug-induced hallucinations, then. They actually seem like they have some real validity to them.
Well, I'm absolutely convinced that there are many, many aspects of these states that reveal normally invisible realities, you know, that were, which are ontogenetically real. They are actually there, and they're available to all of us under certain circumstances. And as I mentioned before, you know, many of them can be actually verified using somehow methods that we use in science, and others can be just identified through means that we had to develop specifically for these kinds of experiences. But I am absolutely convinced that there are normally invisible realities that are extremely important part of reality, and there are also ways, very valid ways, of perceiving our everyday reality in a very new way. So there are two types of experiences that we can have, two categories of experiences that are spiritual in nature and reveal some either new perspectives on everyday reality or some completely new, normally invisible realities. So the first experience could become could be called the experience of the immanent divine, when we have the experience and we watch the world with our eyes open and suddenly see it in a very new way. We see them not as the material world, but we see these scenes as being basically created by, on one level, by energy, on another level, just by experience, that being sort of virtual realities. We also can perceive that that objects are not really separate from each other, that there is a behind, on a deeper level, there is a continuity where there is fundamental oneness, and that the world of separation is kind of teased out of this unitive cosmic matrix. And we see the world as the work of higher creative principles. So we see the world as numinous. And then there is a way that we can experience a non-ordinary state where it reveals certain domains of reality that we had no idea existed. So that would be the experience where an entirely different dimension kind of unfolds, to use the terminology by David Bohm, unfolds into our everyday consciousness. So suddenly we have the vision of Jesus or Virgin Mary, or it could be Kali or Shiva, or we can have the experience that we are in heaven or hell or in paradise. So this, you know, we can encounter various archetypal beings or experience different archetypal motifs and so on. And again, as I said before, when we then try to verify it, we'll find out that even if we did not know the mythology that was revealed here, that we had access to objective information. We can read about it in books of mythology of these different cultures. Now, what is interesting about the experience of the immanent divine, that in a certain way you see the world much more the way the most advanced science, quantum relativistic physics, sees it. For quantum relativistic physicists, there are not separate objects in the universe. If you go deep into the analysis of matter, you will find out that on the subatomic level, there is just one energetic continuum. For example, there's nothing static. The whole universe is really in movement. David, vibrations, vibratory system. You know, David Bohm argued that we shouldn't even use nouns because the universe is really in movement. We shouldn't talk about tables and chairs, but tabling and chairing. You know, Sten Groffing, Lamping, and so on. San Francisco, New York, because to see the world as full of static, solid objects is some kind of a peculiar illusion, something that the Hindus call Maya. It's a peculiar illusion that gives us the sense that we are material beings living in a material universe. And of course, the mystics and particularly the Eastern mystics have been saying this for centuries. But now, since the first three decades of the 20th century, they were joined by quantum relativistic physicists. So in a sense, strangely enough, in these non-ordinary states, you see the world more for what it is according to the most advanced science, rather than what we see in this naive pedestrian consciousness. And then we have also, as I mentioned before, we have proof that some of these normally invisible realities are not just hallucinations or fantasies, but that they are objectively there. So for me, the giving the example for the immanent divine, I usually refer to television. You know, it would be like watching black and white television and suddenly colors come in. So if we have the experience of the immanent divine, we still see some of the old elements in the world. We see trees and people and fields and rivers and so on, but we see them in some fundamentally different way. A new dimension, the dimension of the spirituality, of the luminosity, is coming into it. Whereas the experience of the transcendental divine would be more like being limited to one television channel and suddenly finding out that you can sort of push some buttons and some more channels sort of come in, which were available before, but you somehow were not aware of it. And it's very interesting to me that it's such an alien concept to people from our culture, when we have actually created something similar through electronic technology. You know, as we are sitting in our room, there is enormous amount of information that could become an experience. For example, there's all the information from the shortwave radio stations from all over the world. So we could listen to news from Tokyo, or we could hear a concert from Johannesburg. And more than that, we have now any number of these satellites, and we have television channels that are being beamed down. So we could actually have a visual and acoustic experience. We could watch a Playboy channel or a Hollywood classic or a Mickey Mouse cartoon or or Star Trek. And we know intellectually that this is the case, but we don't experience it unless we have some specific technology, which is the television set that mediates that. And the corresponding instrument in non-ordinary states would be change of consciousness. You have to change the state of consciousness, and then these other channels become available to us. And if you and I would have experiences of those domains, we can reach consensus. If you have the experience of Shiva's heaven, and I have the experience of Shiva's heaven, we can talk about it in a way we would talk about Westminster Abbey or the Houses of Parliament when both of us visited London.
That's fascinating. Would you say that there are levels to these experiences, or do you take LSD and there's only one experience, or are there processes and levels and variations of the experience?
Well, there are many, many different levels, you know. So there is a level of the psychedelic experience, for example, which happens typically when people begin, and they begin with lower dosages, let's say 100 micrograms, if they have the privilege of knowing how much they are taking, which I have always had because I was doing official research with pharmaceutically pure substances, whereas people who buy it somewhere in the street, they don't really know how much they are getting, and frequently even not what they are getting. But somebody would start this psychedelic experimentation, let's say with 100 micrograms of LSD, the whole experience could be just aesthetic. You could see images very similar to what we call fractals, the computer-generated images, you know, based on nonlinear equations. People talk about kaleidoscopic displays, or it was like stained glass windows in the Gothic cathedrals, or arabesques from Muslim mosques, and so on. So there's a level of the experience which is just abstract, which is basically aesthetic. And then as you move through that level, then you would be in the level of postnatal biography. And again, there are people who can have a whole session on that level, when it's like a really deepened and accelerated psychoanalysis, where you would be dealing with experiences from your infancy, from your childhood, from your later life, getting insights, bringing up repressed or forgotten memories, you know, processing emotionally and so on. And then there is that whole level which I call perinatal. And again, for many people, that could be the full content of the session. It takes them to their biological birth or to prenatal life and so on. And then there is the possibility of having any number of the experiences on the transpersonal level that I described.
How do you know when treating a patient with psychedelics, how do you know when you've achieved the desired result or cure that you're looking for?
Well, you know, the traditional approach, my background is as a clinical psychiatrist, and what you do there, you basically use the intensity of the symptoms as a measure how bad things are or how good things are. You know, less anxiety, the patient's improving, less depressed today, and so on. From the psychedelic perspective, this is a very superficial kind of a measure. Actually, what you will learn is that, in a sense, the symptoms in many instances, If this is not an organic biological problem, but if it's just a psychogenic psychological problem, the symptoms, like in homeopathy, are actually expression of the healing impulse. We had very difficult, challenging history. Some of us, in childhood, infancy, but either the experience of biological vaginal birth or cesarean birth and so on, possible problems in prenatal life and so on. So we carry a lot of this undigested psychological material and things that happen to us also in postnatal life. And then when symptoms come, the organism is really trying to get rid of something. And the only way it can get rid of it is to bring it to your consciousness for processing. And a lot of current psychiatry is really focusing just on the symptoms. So when we can do something with the symptoms, we consider the patient to be improved. We look also at some other parameters, like how the person is functioning in life, you know, the relationships, sort of professional capacity and so on. But a lot of it has to do with symptoms. So that certainly is one of the indicators. If a patient would come with asthma and then he doesn't have asthmatic attacks anymore, or the attacks became much weaker, then we would say there was a, you know, therapeutic success. But what actually happens with psychedelics is that in many instances the symptoms are temporarily intensified, and then you go into the symptom and through the symptom. And then not only does the symptom disappear, but you go through some kind of experience of personal growth or transformation, so that your personality will be changing with this uncovering method. Whereas with the covering method, very frequently it leads to actually impoverishment rather than expansion or growth. That people who take particularly larger dosages of tranquilizers, you know, they experience kind of inhibition. They are in a sense reduced or impoverished. So they feel better in the sense that they don't have the symptoms, but there is a certain that the price that you pay for it as well. Even beside the you know, the most obvious, which is different side effects that the medication can have. So that's one of the very interesting things that we see. We used to see with psychedelics. Now we see it with the breath work that we do, that you work through symptoms, but you also go through very profound changes. For example, in terms of your self-image, self-acceptance, your level of tolerance, your level of empathy towards our people. A lot of people develop spontaneously very high ecological awareness when they had experiences with other, you know, becoming members of other species, becoming fish in a polluted river and so on, or experiencing the fundamental oneness that we have with nature. They come with a very strong sense that we have to take care of our environment. As biological beings, we have to be concerned about having clean water, or clean air, having clean soil that's nourishing us, where we grow our vegetables and so on. That no reasons like profit or, you know, ideological reasons, military, political reasons and so on, are good enough to neglect some of these fundamental imperatives which have to do with ecology. And, a lot of people develop a sense that violence is not an acceptable way of solving problems. So there are very, you know, very profound changes, including the spiritual opening that we already talked about. So those are all things that would not happen with tranquilizers or antidepressants, but that happen in the course of this kind of uncovering therapy, whether you use some psychoactive substances for it or use some powerful non-drug experiential methods of psychotherapy.
And you talked about transpersonal experiences, and you mentioned transpersonal psychology earlier. Would you talk about that a little bit more?
Yes. Well, I'd say a few words about the history. If you look at the history of psychiatry and psychology, psychotherapy, if you look at the first half of the 20th century, it was basically dominated by two schools. One was Freudian psychoanalysis, the other one was behaviorism. But somewhere in the 50s, there was a growing dissatisfaction with these two schools. Behaviorism basically focusing on the work with animals and trying to make conclusions for human psychology, psychoanalysis focusing mostly on psychopathology and drawing sort of conclusions about the human psyche from there. And the main spokesman of this movement of the dissatisfaction became Abraham Maslow, and published a very, very strong criticism of these two schools that were dominating academic psychiatry. Gave different reasons why this was an inadequate approach to the psyche. And he and Tony Sutich developed something called humanistic psychology, where there was a tremendous emphasis on growth of self-realization, focusing on what Maslow called the growing tip of the population rather than just the patient population. Using introspective data, which behaviorism refused, wanted to draw all the data from observing behavior and so on. And so they started this humanistic psychology that became a kind of an umbrella under which also a number of new therapies developed, called experiential therapies. Gestalt therapy would be one example, various neo-Reichian approaches, primal therapy, bioenergetics, and so on. And then humanistic psychology became very popular, both in professional circles but also in lay circles, many people attending workshops of these different methods of humanistic psychology and so on. But the creators of this movement themselves, Maslow and Sutich, became dissatisfied with the school that they themselves created, realizing that they left out some extremely important aspects of human psyche, primarily spirituality, the mystical dimension, things that happen to us in spiritual practice, during meditation, things like the artistic inspiration and so on. So they started working on a yet different branch of psychology, which they wanted to call transhumanistic, going beyond humanistic psychology. And this is when I was invited in. I sent Maslow a large manuscript when I came to the United States, and he invited me. We had a wonderful discussion where he saw that much of what I have described in terms of mystical experiences in psychedelic sessions paralleled his research with what he called peak experiences, which were spontaneous mystical experiences. He studied a large group of people who had these peak experiences, these spontaneous mystical experiences, and he realized that these were not pathological states the way current psychiatry sees that. We don't have a dimension spiritual mystical experience. People who have mystical experiences would get a pretty nasty diagnosis. They would be seen as psychotics. So he realized that if anything, that these mystical experiences at least potentially were supernormal. People who were allowed to experience them fully and integrated them well, they moved in the direction of self-realization, self-actualization, and so on. really very similar to what we saw in responsibly run psychedelic sessions. So we became close friends. He invited me to this small group of people who were working on this new school of psychology. And I brought in the psychedelic observations, and they actually accepted my term that I used for this category of psychedelic experiences, transpersonal, and they changed the term transhumanistic psychology into transpersonal psychology. So transpersonal psychology, then the way we saw it, became a psychology that studies the whole spectrum of human experience, including these non-ordinary states. And also psychology that is trying to show that spirituality is complementary to science, that it's in no way correctly understood spirituality based on personal spiritual experience is incompatible with science. Ken Wilber, who wrote a book, A Sociable God, said something very interesting. He said, if there seems to be conflict between science and religion, it's very likely bogus science and bogus religion, or pseudoscience, pseudo-religion, that people in these camps don't understand what the other group is talking about, and they very likely are not even the best example of their own discipline. Because, you see, correctly understood, science studies a significantly different realm of reality than a spiritual discipline. So those are complementary. Those are not in any kind of conflict. Once we get through that or over that primitive conflict created really by misunderstanding. For example, that if people from the religious circles talk about heaven, that they talk about the same heaven that the astronomers are speaking. You know, now we have Hubble telescope and we have mapped every part of the sky, night sky. And nobody has seen angels or God in the telescope, so we have disproved religion. Or we know that in the middle of the earth there is liquid nickel and iron. There is no place for the caves of Satan, for hell. Or we pretty much know the surface of the globe, and we know there is nowhere the paradise the way it's described in the Bible. This is what people tried to do initially. They were trying to find the paradise on the surface of the planet. So the only people who can really speak with any kind of authority about religion and spirituality are people who study non-ordinary states of consciousness. Because heaven, hell, paradise, you know, the way Huxley showed in his book, Heaven and Hell, are concepts related to what you experience in non-ordinary states of consciousness. They don't describe any realities that are part of the material world. So physicists or other scientific disciplines that study the material world have really nothing relevant to say about the spiritual dimension, because they simply don't have access to it unless they are people like Einstein, you know, who are able to do something that would be in India called Jnana Yoga, that they study nature to such depth that they realize that the world didn't create itself, that there is a creative principle, there is a master blueprint of a superior intelligence than in our usual state of consciousness we can't even comprehend. So people who really push their discipline to the very edge, like Einstein, they basically discover something that Einstein called cosmic religion. You know, when after you have really learned enough how intricate, how complex reality is and the unbelievable intelligence that you find in the animal world or even in the inorganic world, that you see the luminosity in the world that before you considered to be sort of ordinary material, nothing special world.
You talked about a technique that you and your wife developed, holotropic breathing. Could you talk more about the technique and as well as what spawned your development of the technique?
Yes, this is something that we developed when we were at Esalen, where we didn't have the permission to use psychedelics anymore. And we were doing workshops, you know, where I was primarily talking about the what we saw during psychedelic research and all the implications for psychology, psychiatry, you know, psychotherapy, religion, art, and so on. And people usually became quite dissatisfied. They say, well, we are talking about all these wonderful experiences, but can't we do something, you know, that will give us a taste of what those experiences are? We don't want to just hear about it. And I would say, you know, sorry, I don't have the license to give you LSD at Esalen. This was bound to a particular place, the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center. And so at a certain point, we started experimenting with breath and music and a certain kind of body work. And we found out that people could have very powerful experiences with these very simple means. So we developed, you know, what's now called holotropic breath work. Basically, what workshop looks like. We also have training where people come, you know, and go through the training to become facilitators of holotropic breathwork. But if I describe what a workshop would look like, people get together, frequently do it. The shortest time we can do it is a weekend, where let's say on the evening of Friday, I would give a talk, giving them some kind of a basic theory about non-ordinary states, and then also the information about the breathwork itself, what they will need to actually do the breathwork. And then we ask people to pair up. We work with half of the group at a time, and everybody has a partner. We call this a sitter, for lack of a better name. And then the next day, the Saturday, we have two sessions, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, where basically we give a kind of relaxation exercise at the beginning to bring people into the present moment, in touch with their body, and then we ask them to breathe a little faster, a little deeper than usual, tying the exhalation and the inhalation into a circle of breath and really shifting their attention from their head to the body and to the breath. And then we start playing powerful evocative music, much of which comes from native traditions or from spiritual traditions, music that was specifically developed to induce these non-ordinary states. And then, you know, we just walk around, and unless some special situations develop, people can really do it themselves. It's really like a profound meditation enhanced by the music and by the breath. And normally, you know, sensations, physical sensations emerge, emotions emerge, memories emerge, people have experiences. And the basic idea is you just continue to breathe. You, whatever emerges, you experience it fully, you find ways of expressing it. And in many instances, the material that emerges is resolved, and then people, although they continue to breathe, the experience quiets down, and towards the end we play very kind of timeless, floating, meditative music, and then people, when they feel back to normal, they go and they draw or paint something that we call a mandala. And then in the evening on Saturday, we have a sharing group where people talk about their experiences with the help of the mandalas. And then Sunday morning, we usually have a what we call a forum, where people can ask questions about their own process, about the breathwork, about the technique, about the theory, bring things from the small groups and so on, so that we can take it in any direction that that people are interested in. I should mention we'll have actually our next workshop is in mid-January at the Clarion Hotel near the San Francisco airport, which is still open, you know, for people who would like to come. And we have a website which is very easy to remember, holotropic.com. They can also get it under my name on the internet. It's an opportunity for people to actually have a personal experience rather than just read about these experiences.
That's fantastic. How would you say that the experiences between holotropic breathwork and, say, LSD or psilocybin compare? How are they the same? How are they different? That sort of thing.
Well, I would say, you know, the basic commonality is that people have experiences from the same cartography. My first book was called Realms of the Human Unconscious. And I described there basically the new cartography, which doesn't have just the biographical level, but also the perinatal and the transpersonal level, the different kind of experiences you can have in psychedelic sessions. And then later we discovered, when we started doing the breathwork, that the same map can be used for the breathwork. And then we started also working with people who had spontaneous non-ordinary states. That would be labeled as psychotic by current psychiatry, but we started talking about spiritual emergency. We believe that a certain significant subgroup of these people who have so-called psychotic experiences are actually experiences of stormy spiritual opening. We wrote a book about it called The Stormy Search for the Self, and another group called Spiritual Emergency. So we found out that the large cartography of the psyche can be used in all those three situations, in psychedelic sessions, in the sessions of holotropic breathwork, but also in spontaneous episodes of non-ordinary states. And then you can apply it to, you know, shamanic work, you can apply it to systematic spiritual practice and so on.
What about things like you see on something such as DMT, where you go into another world where it's almost like it has walls and just, you know, it almost appears that there's solid form shapes there and that sort of thing. Is that something that's also found in breath work?
Okay, well, so, you know, so far I talked about the similarities. The similarity is you can have biographical experiences, perinatal experiences, transpersonal experiences with the breath work. Now, the way you experience it's different. For example, the experiences with LSD, mescaline, psilocybin are generally more visual, more colorful in that sense. The breath work focuses more on the emotions and the body and psychological insights. The other problem is the limitation of the breathwork, that, you know, you can only breathe so fast or so deep or so well, whereas with LSD you can take 100, you can take 200, you can take 500. People have taken, you know, 1,000 and more. So this is not something that you can do with the breathwork. On the positive side, with the breathwork, you are much more in control. In other words, you have to work for having the experience, and you can somehow decide, you know, if it gets too heavy, you can decide not to go as deep into the experience. Now, this is not necessarily recommended, but there is a possibility, and some people appreciate it, that it's not so overwhelming, that you still have some kind of a decision to make in the, inside of the session. On the other hand, if you take a psychedelic, a big dose of psychedelic, there's no good way of interrupting it. As we talked about it, you know, to administer tranquilizers is not really a good way of terminating a bad trip that's going to freeze people in the bad place and prevent any kind of resolution.
Well, except in the case...
Okay, also...
Oh, I was just going to say, in the case of DMT or 5-methoxy-DMT, it would only probably be a 5 or 10 minute experience in most cases.
Okay, there's another thing is that... you know, there are certain differences also between psychedelics. There's, for example, that whole group of psychedelics related to amphetamine, which is which are substances like MDA, MMDA, MDMA, which is ecstasy, or ADAM, some people call it, FTP, and so on. Those also tend to be much less visual, more emotional, more sort of philosophical. It's also, you know, something that is much easier to experience. Those are more difficult physiologically on your body. They're related to the sympathetic nervous system, and so it influences your heart, your blood pressure, and so on, much more significantly than LSD would. So those can be physiologically dangerous if people increase the dosage, but the psychologically the experience is much easier. It's difficult to have a bad trip on something like ecstasy. People frequently make parallels between the breathwork and ecstasy rather than breathwork and LSD because of the the less expressed visual aspect of that experience. Now, with DMT, if you take a really big dose, you can get to a situation where all the levels that have some form disappear. You might lose contact with the reality around you. You might make it through the archetypal world. And you get to a state which I believe is similar to what the Tibetan Book of the Dead describes as Dharmakaya, the primary clear light, where the, all of existence is just this sort of enormous source, where one aspect of it is light, but usually it doesn't come close to describing it if you say it was, you know, fantastic, radiant sort of source. Because you also feel that there is enormous intelligence, creative intelligence there. You transcend polarities. You cannot say whether it's demonic or divine. I mean, those categories doesn't apply. It's like all of existence there in, you know, in this incredible source. And that experience, as you say, can happen, you know, easily within half an hour.
Definitely. So going back to Asalen, what were some of the more profound things that occurred there, and who did you work with there? You mentioned Joseph Campbell earlier. Weren't you a friend of his?
Well, Asalen is a very, very fascinating place. It's kind of a mecca of the human potential movement. It's in an incredibly beautiful setting. It's a narrow strip of land between the Pacific and the mountains, and the place has hot springs. It used to be a very sacred place of the Esalen Indians. So the name Esalen was the name of the tribe, like the Sioux or the Apache and so on. Those are Esalen Indians. And when the highway, the scenic highway, Highway 1, opened, Dr. Murphy from Salinas bought this property and built a motel there for people traveling up and down the coast. And the hot springs were like a special, you know, fringe benefit in the motel. And then when he died, Michael Murphy, his son, was in Oroville. He was in the Aurobindo ashram doing meditation, I think, for about 18 months. And he inherited SLN. And, you know, he didn't want to run a motel. So at the time, he was interested very much in Indian philosophy and in psychology. So he and Dick Price co-founded SLN as a kind of the first human potential center. So SLN has meeting rooms, it has cabins, it has these hot springs. And he decided that he will offer it for seminars, for workshops, by people who developed some really new methods of doing psychological, emotional work, spiritual work, and so on. People who are pioneers in their own field, but the work is so new and avant-garde that it would not have much chance in more traditional settings, you know, psychiatric hospitals or universities or research institutes and so on. And so SLN started offering these workshops. And there's some amazing people around SLN, you know, Abraham Maslow, for example, Aldous Huxley, and later Fritz Perls came and developed the Gestalt therapy. Ida Rolf lived there, developed the Rolfing. Moshe Feldenkrais was visiting frequently. He developed the Feldenkrais method of body work. Will Schutz, who became a famous figure in group therapy, lived there. Virginia Satir was a frequent guest, who developed family therapy and so on. So it's a very, very exciting place. I spent 14 years there, living in this, you know, beautiful place on the ocean, having whales passing by and seals and otters, and then on the land of sort of the monarch butterflies that were traveling and sort of ending up on trees at SLN. And at the same time, this unbelievably stimulating atmosphere where people, you know, very interesting people came and they were basically offering these workshops. You didn't have to travel to find them. They were all interested in coming to SLN. And I was amazingly fortunate to have spent there 2.5 years with Gregory Bateson, again, an amazing scientist who had actually cancer, sitting on his big vein, vena cava. And they opened him up and they gave him 4 weeks to live. And Michael Murphy invited him to Esalen, saying, you know, why don't you come die at Esalen? Esalen is a beautiful place for that kind of a process. And he came and lived 2.5 years. You know, anybody who had any healing ambitions descended on him, you know. And, you know, whatever caused that, he lived 2.5 years instead of 4 weeks. And we both lived there at the same time, and we were called scholars in residence. And so I had this amazing opportunity for hundreds of hours of really profound discussions with Gregory Bateson. And he also invited him to be a guest faculty in month-long seminars that Christina and I were organizing at SLN. And that was the place where also Joseph Campbell came for quite regularly and became another very close friend. He's a brilliant, brilliant mind, really walking lexicon of mythology of the world. And I really learned a lot from him about the relevance of mythology for psychology.
In your books, you often discuss Freud and Jung, and I noticed earlier you also mentioned Neo-Reichian concepts. Would you discuss how Wilhelm Reich's orgasm energy affects your research into holotropic breathwork and psychedelics?
Well, you know, Reich had enormous influence in that stage of the development of psychology where humanistic psychology was dominant. So that many of the neo-Reichian approaches, Reich brought the emphasis on the body. Freud was very shy in that sense. He avoided physical contact. He wanted it to be a purely psychological process, and so did the orthodox Freudians. For example, my analyst, I had psychoanalysis for seven years, and he didn't shake hands with me. You know, I came three times a week for 7 years. He never shook hands because he believed that it would contaminate the transference-counter-transference relationship. So Reich was very, very different. I mean, he believed that if you have traumatic experiences, that there's energy stored in your body, in the muscles and also in the inner organs. He called it the character armor. And he brought the bodywork into psychotherapy. And he also experimented some with the breathing. So in that sense, there is a similarity with the breathwork, because we work with the body and we work with breath. But where the similarity ends is Reich was very anti-spiritual. He believed that if you are a mystic, it's because you are not able to have a full sexual orgasm, and that you are sort of, you know, escaping sort of into some religious fantasies because you don't have good sex. And he believed that, you know, there are people who have good orgasm are not mystics, and that mystics don't have good orgasms, which certainly is not something that we have observed. We actually observe that when people have powerful psychedelic experiences, where they resolve some issues, particularly some issues about birth and so on, that their sexual experience becomes much more, much fuller, much more powerful, also becomes more, much more associated with love, with loving behavior, and with, you know, tactile behavior, long sort of physical contact after the orgasm, rather than considering sex over when the orgasm happens and so on. So we see actually sexuality as being very closely related to spirituality. And this is all reflected, of course, in Tantra, when you use sexual union to achieve a spiritual experience. So that's a big difference between the work with holotropic breathwork or psychedelics and the Reichian approach. But he certainly was one who brought the body and breath, you know, into psychotherapy.
A few weeks ago, I had an interesting moment of synchronicity that I'd like to mention, and then have you discuss some of your own work into synchronicity. But I was actually doing an interview with Dr. James DeMeo, the author of Sahurasia, who's one of the leading researchers in Reichian theory. And while I was on the phone with him, whom I haven't spoken to on the phone for about 2 years, a friend of mine called me to discuss DeMeo's work that I hadn't spoken to in more than a year. And this actually happened while I was on the phone speaking to DeMeo. And so it was a very bizarre moment of synchronicity that this guy calls me while I'm on the phone with him. But could you talk about some of your own research into synchronicity and some of the things you've experienced?
Well, I became very, very fascinated by this phenomenon of synchronicity, and a good part of my book, maybe one third of the book, When the Impossible Happens, are stories about very unusual synchronicities. A synchronicity is something that was brought into psychology by Carl Gustav Jung, who observed some very, very unusual coincidences in his life. but not just coincidences, but coincidences of a particular kind, where one aspect of the coincidence was an inner experience, like a dream or a visionary experience, and the other aspect of it was in what we call, we consider objective reality, the material world. For example, having a dream and then the following day having the thing that you saw in a dream actually happen. Or his famous example is when he worked with a patient who was quite resistant to the Jungian philosophy, and they were analyzing a dream, and in the dream was a golden scarab. And the patient had difficulties with the interpretations and so on, and suddenly something hit the window, and Jung got up and walked to the window and came back with a what's called gold chafer beetle, kind of a golden beetle, you know, the closest thing you can have to a scarab in Switzerland, and at the same time very rare. And he just showed it on his the palm of his hand to the patient, and this was, you know, such a powerful impulse, this coincidence for her, that it was a turning point in therapy. I have in my book an experience that was related by Joseph Campbell in one of the seminars that we had. And it it's something that Joseph Campbell talked about in one of his seminars, and coincidentally, it also involves an insect. Joseph Campbell told a story when he was working in his study on the first volume of this Encyclopedia of Mythology, which is called The Way of the Animal Powers, which is about shamanic mythologies of the world. And he lived at that time on the 14th floor of a high-rise building in Lower Manhattan. And he said his study had two sets of windows. One had a beautiful view of Hudson River. The second set of windows was overlooking Sixth Avenue, which was a much less interesting view. So they seldom, if at all, outside of the cleaning, they opened those windows. And at this time, when this happened, he was working on the mythology of the Kalahari Bushmen from Africa. And the central figure there in this is the praying mantis. It's like a heroic mythological figure in that mythology. So he was surrounded by all these papers and pictures of the praying mantis, and suddenly he had this impulse to go and open one of the windows that they never opened. And he looked out, automatically turned his head to one side, and there on the 14th floor of this high-rise building in Manhattan was a large specimen of praying mantis. And he said, looked at him, and then continued climbing up. So again, that's a major example of synchronicity. You know, it's difficult to imagine how the praying mantis got there in the first place, but, you know, you might consider it possible, if not plausible. But that connection between Joseph Campbell, you know, being immersed in this mythology where it played such an important role, having that totally irrational impulse to go and open the window for, you know, no good reason, and finding out there was a praying mantis right there is quite amazing. So this is the kind of phenomenon that Jung described, and he actually took 20 years before he dared to publish it, because he knew this goes to the roots, you know, of scientific thinking, because the scientific thinking uses linear causality. Everything that happens has a cause and has an effect, and the whole universe is seen as chains of causes-effect. cause and effect, with the exception, of course, of the beginning or the cause of causes, you know, where this breaks down. So he took 20 years until he had enough examples, and he wrote this very interesting essay called Synchronicity and a Causal Connecting Principle. So in my book, I have, you know, given a lot of examples from our own life and from my work with clients where the synchronicity was so dominant. And we have, you know, repeatedly observed that in the same way in which a non-ordinary state somehow increased the incidence of psychic phenomena in general, they seem to significantly increase the incidence of synchronicity in people's lives. To the point that, you know, the psychiatrists notice that because many of their patients are reporting these amazing synchronicities that happen in their life. And because, you know, the philosophy of psychiatry is materialistic and the world is seen as chains of causes and effect, when patients start talking about these unusual, meaningful synchronicities, they see them as delusional misperception. So we have a term for it. It's a delusion of reference. When people refer to themselves in a meaningful way, things that possibly cannot be meaningful or can at best be coincidental, reflecting some kind of statistical probability.
You've done a significant amount of research into death and dying and death and rebirth. What is your interest in that area, and why is it important?
Well, as I mentioned, I came to psychiatry as a psychoanalyst. I was interested in psychoanalysis, which is limited to postnatal biography, you know, the problems with nursing, weaning, toilet training, Oedipal problems, you know, psychosexual traumas and so on. And I started using LSD because I was very dissatisfied with the efficacy of psychoanalysis, and I believed that somehow LSD would accelerate or deepen that process, which it certainly did. But as we were doing these repeated LSD sessions, sooner or later, every single person that we worked with would transcend the biographical level. And the first thing that they started experiencing was their personal birth. You know, they started having the experiences that their life is threatened, they are trapped, caught, they had difficulties breathing, they felt, you know, pressures on different parts of their body and so on. And they had all kinds of concrete elements that represented identification with the fetus passing through these different stages of the birth canal. And what was also interesting that these different experiences from the birth canal functioned also as a kind of window or door into the collective unconscious. So there were some special selections from the collective unconscious that were also part of these sessions. For example, being stuck in the stage of birth when the cervix is not open, which is a very unpleasant kind of a claustrophobic state, could be associated with images of hell on the deepest archetypal level. Or we can have identification from the historical unconscious with people who were in some similar situations, like in a prison, in the concentration camp, in the torture chamber of the Inquisition, and so on. So there was an opening into the collective unconscious, and these fetal experiences were mixed with the experiences from the collective unconscious. When it was the stage of birth where the cervix opened, that there is this struggle, you know, through the birth canal, there would be images of revolutions coming from the collective unconscious. enough of the oppression. We will, you know, mobilize and we will overthrow the tyrant and we will all breathe freely and so on. And then when people completed that process, it would not be just the process of being born biologically, but there was a spiritual element. They were emerging into this luminous light, which was not just the ordinary light. So it became the experience of psycho-spiritual death and rebirth. And then I realized, you know, that this was the probably single most important thing in the whole history of religion, the ritual and spiritual history of humanity. Career of many shamans begins by a spontaneous visionary death rebirth experience when they have the experience of going into the underworld, being put through some enormous ordeals, being dismembered, dying, and then being reborn, and then having all these connections with nature, and then traveling to the supernal world. Then I also realized that the whole ritual life, the rites of passage, they're all about death, rebirth experiences. The initiates, you know, go into a situation where they are isolated from their tribe, and they're put through some powerful mind-altering procedure, and then they have the experience of moving to a new level through a death rebirth experience. And this is interpreted in rites of passage as dying in the old role and being born into the new one. For example, in a puberty rite, you die as a boy or a girl and you emerge from there as an adult, and you have a sense that something significant really died and something new, equally significant or more significant, was born. And then we have the whole history of the ancient mysteries of death and rebirth, the mysteries of Isis and Osiris, the Dionysian rites, the mysteries of Eleusis and so on. And then also the history of powerful death rebirth experiences in the great religions of the world. So the Hindus have a state which they referred to as Dvija, which means being twice born. One's born like everybody else in the biological way, but the other one is the spiritual birth, the psycho-spiritual death rebirth. And that is not true about everybody. Those are certain selected people, and they, you know, they act differently. They have a different hierarchy of values. They perceive themselves and the world differently, and so on. In Christianity, we have a similar kind of a situation about being born again. There's in the New Testament, there is a wonderful scene between Jesus and Nicodemus, where Jesus talks about the need to be born again. And Nicodemus doesn't understand. He says, Jesus, how can I be born again? Look at me. I'm a big man. And look at the small pelvis of my mother. How can I be born again? And Jesus says, I'm not talking about being born from flesh. I'm talking about being born from spirit and water. So it's a very, very significant element in Christianity, either in the full form, which we read about in the Bible, or, you know, many people these days have a kind of a half-baked experience that doesn't really bring them to full kind of spiritual opening, but they get stuck in a certain kind of a, you know, fundamentalist interpretation of that, which is not really very spiritual.
Doblin sent me a few questions that he wanted me to ask you, and he writes, he sent me, what promising research from the past do you think should be resumed?
Well, some of it is already happening. You know, there's several places now where people are repeating pretty much the research we did with cancer patients, terminal cancer patients, which I think was some of the most rewarding and most moving research we have done, to see how people, you know, facing the ultimate, the kind of terminal cancer, the imminence of death and so on, how they can move psychologically to a completely different place, and how they can even experience relief from pain. So that's, you know, it's really fantastic, in my opinion, that this research is returning, because I think it was shame that particularly in this indication, you know, it was not allowed in actual clinical practice. The study of the Good Friday experiment was again repeated recently at Johns Hopkins, with very, very strict methodology, showing that psilocybin, the active alkaloid from the magic mushrooms of the Mazateks, can induce mystical experiences. By the way, some of the studies with cancer patients also using psilocybin, which doesn't have the bad name that LSD has, and has at the same time has similar, you know, beneficial effects if used properly. So, you know, repetition of the clinical studies, certainly we need, you know, much more work done, because it shows psyche, the human psyche, in a completely new way. And I believe that if we study what's happening in these states and around them, like the synchronicities, that it would lead to a revolution in psychiatry and psychology and psychotherapy that would be really comparable to what happened to the physicists in the first three decades of the 20th century, when they had to move from Newtonian physics first to Einstein and then to quantum physics. And I believe that in a sense it would be a very logical completion of that revolution that already happened in physics. So it has a tremendous significance that we call heuristic, H-E-U-R-I-S-T-I-C, from the Greek eureka or eureka, which means I found it, you know, using psychedelics as a tool of knowledge, as a microscope, as a telescope of the psyche. And I certainly would love some continuation of the studies on creativity, you know, to be able to do sessions with people who have some high qualification, like in quantum physics, in biology, like what happened to Francis Crick with the discovery of the molecule of DNA under the influence of LSD. So that kind of research could be repeated.
I think I used to know him. Does he live down in Orange County?
No, that is another Nobel, Nobel Prize winner. The name now escapes me, but there was another Nobel Prize winner who quite explicitly mentioned his use of LSD and how it helped him in his problem solution.
Yeah, he used to. I used to work down there, and he would come in and talk to me every once in a while his wife shopped, and he didn't like to shop, so he would hang out and talk to me about his research and drugs and religion and things like that. So
yeah, you don't remember the name, do you?
It momentarily escapes me. It momentarily escapes me as well. I could call my former boss and ask him. He would know who I was talking about, but I would have to contact him about it.
No, but Crick was in England.
Okay. What research has never been done before that you think should be undertaken?
Well, you know, this research with creativity has not really been done in a sufficiently significant way. There was a study that was done by Bob Mogar and Jim Fadiman, where they were using mescaline in people who were trying to solve a problem but had difficulties really finding the solution. And so that's the only paper I really know where it was formalized. You know, we had a lot of sort of observations and insights, but those were informal and would be called kind of anecdotal. So we would need some really, you know, systematic study. I think it's that's the most fascinating dimension according to my opinion.
How do we avoid
other study that I would like to see is to do a comparative study of people born by elective cesarean section and people vaginally born and what the differences would be. And also studying the lives of these people, how different forms of birth influence the course of life and development of different forms of emotional and psychosomatic disorders. I think that would be a very, very important research to do.
So how do we avoid triggering the negative backlash of the psychedelic 60s as research moves forward today?
Well, I think, you know, the hysteria now has subsided somewhat, and also the people who are now in positions of decision making are they were on the campuses in the 60s, and so they have somewhat different image of psychedelics than the, you know, the old generation had in the 60s. I think the most important thing is to do really responsible research and be sure that, you know, some of the researchers who are doing it officially with the government's blessing and permission and so on, don't go astray and don't do crazy things, that they stay, you know, within their own realm of research, which was, of course, Leary's problem. And to a much lesser extent, the problem of Richard Alpert or Ramdas. You know, there is a possibility also that as the situation in the world is getting worse and worse, that people would be open to try some more radical approaches. And certainly people who experience psychedelics repeatedly in a responsible way, they experience a transformation of a kind that would certainly make survival of humanity more plausible, you know, becoming less aggressive, more spiritual, more ecological aware, and so on.
So are you optimistic or pessimistic about humanity's future?
I am, you know, moderately optimistic. And this optimism is not based on my observation of what's happening in the world. That looks pretty gloomy, particularly in the recent decade or so. It's based on the fact that very likely things are happening on some other levels in which we don't directly perceive. For example, had you told me, you know, being from Eastern Europe, of course, I'm following with great interest what's happening there. And had you told me 10 days, 2 weeks before the Berlin Wall went down that Gorbachev would say, well, you Germans, you can put down the wall, you can unite Germany. And as far as the Hungarians, the Czechs, and, you know, the Poles and Yugoslavians and Romanians are concerned, you can have your freedom, you know, we are not interested anymore. I would think that you're crazy, because there's nothing in the world that was happening that gave you any indication that this might happen.
How have you changed your model of the mind, as you've described in Realms of the Human Unconscious, since you published that book?
Say it once more.
I said, how have you changed your model of the mind, as described in your book, Realms of the Human Unconscious, since you published that book?
Well, the cartography has changed very little. I mean, if you look at Psychology of the Future, where I have also a chapter on the cartography, you will see that it's essentially the same. I already had all the basic sort of elements, you know, the biographical, the perinatal, the transpersonal level, all the different types of transpersonal experiences, and also the sense that consciousness is not the product of the brain. That was already quite clear, you know, in the 60s. So not really much has changed. I became much more interested in what can be done with non-drug things, like the breath work, you know, what you can do with just with breath and music and body work. That became really fascinating to me, because as I was working with LSD, I thought that this was this amazing, you know, powerful psychoactive substance that's creating something very, very unique that cannot be matched. And to some extent, it's still true, but not, you know, not quite as much as it was then.
Huh. What's the most important idea you would like the listeners to take away from this discussion?
Well, I think the message I would like to send is the fact that, you know, over 50 years of really intense everyday research of these states have convinced me that they are extremely important, and would be a very important part of our life if we could find a different attitude to it that would be more like what all the pre-industrial cultures had, which held these non-ordinary states in very high esteem, and they had certain special situations in which people had the opportunity to experience non-ordinary states and get insight into the normally hidden dimensions of reality. So I believe that it would be, you know, extremely beneficial if the attitude of the Western civilization could change, and we would sort of bring these states back in some kind of a responsible way, where the risks would be minimized and the benefits would be greatly enhanced. I believe that much of the problems that we have today is that we lost spirituality, you know, true, genuine spirituality based on profound personal experiences under good, responsible conditions. You know, we have religions, but religions are not really of much help. In a sense, they are much more of a problem in the world. You know, the differences between religions are enough for you know, bloody warfare. You know, we are Christians, you are pagans. We are Muslims, you are infidels. We are Jews, you are Goyim. We are Hindus, you are Muslims, and, you know, this place in the world just for one faith. And frequently also the differences within a religion are enough for people to kill each other, like the Shiites and the Sunnis, or the Catholics and the Protestants, and so on. Religion, you know, should unite people. Religo means to bring together again, to bind together again what was fragmented, and that cannot be said about organized religion today, but it certainly could be said about spirituality based on personal experience, which is mystical, which is ecumenical, which is universal, which is all-including, all-inclusive, all-encompassing, and so on. you know, mystics of all times get together just fine. It's the organized religions that get in this kind of internecine conflict.
And we've been speaking with Dr. Stanislav Grof, famed LSD researcher and pioneer. And Stan, would you like to discuss any of your books or websites or anything else that you would like to conclude with?
Well, there are two websites. One of them is holotropic.com, holotropic.com. The other one is my full name written together, stanislavgrof.com. That's my personal website. I think the most relevant books to read would be, first of all, Psychology of the Future, that summarizes all my experiences from about almost 50 years of this work. Then, When the Impossible Happens, which is a book of personal stories, and a very comprehensive book on death, which is called The Ultimate Journey, Consciousness and the Mystery of Death. And then probably from my own books, also The Cosmic Game, which describes the most far out, the mystical, the spiritual, the philosophical insight. And then there are books that are co-authored with my wife Christina. Two of them I mentioned already, which is The Stormy Search for the Self and Spiritual Emergency, and then a compendium which we jointly edited, which is called Spiritual Emergency, and then her own very, very interesting book, which is called The Thirst for Wholeness, on the mystical quest, attachment, and addiction, about you know, the relationship between spirituality, transpersonal psychology, and addiction. So we have written more, but I think this would be the probably the most relevant books to read.
And I personally recommend listeners also read your LSD Psychotherapy. I thought that was a phenomenal book. And Stan, this has been, I have to say, this has been one of the most amazing and enlightening talks I've done, and I really appreciate your time, and I can't thank you enough for taking the time to do this.
Yeah, thank you for having me, and we would love to, when you have the website, let me know, and we would make a link, and then I also, if I can get like a DVD copy, you know, of this, so we can maybe use it in the training when I cannot come, I cannot go personally.
Absolutely. And that concludes Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 12. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I will leave you with a short interview of Dr. Albert Hoffman discussing his first psychedelic trip. Albert Hoffman died in April 2008 at 102 years old.
My work in the ergot field advanced further in other directions. A peculiar presentiment that the substance could possess active properties other than those established in the first investigations and expected induced me 5 years after the first synthesis once again to produce LSD-25 in order to give it again to the pharmacological department for further tests. That was in a way uncommon, as experimental substances, once they had been found uninteresting from a pharmacological aspect, as a rule were definitely stricken from the research program. In the spring of 1943, I repeated the synthesis of LSD-25. This involved, as in the first synthesis, the production of only a few centigrams of this compound. In the final step of the synthesis, during the purification and crystallization of lysergic acid diethylamide in the form of a tartrate, that is a salt of this tartaric acid, I was interrupted in my work by unusual sensations. I take a description of this incident from the report that I wrote at the time to Professor Stoll. Last Friday, April 16, I was forced to interrupt my work in the laboratory in the middle of the afternoon and proceed home as I was seized by a peculiar restlessness combined with a slight dizziness. At home, I lay down and sank into a not unpleasant, intoxicated-like condition that was characterized by an extremely stimulated imagination. In a dreamlike state, with eyes closed, I found the daylight to be unpleasantly glaring. An uninterrupted stream of fantastic pictures of extraordinary plasticity with intense kaleidoscopic-like play of colors surged in upon me. After some 2 hours, this condition faded away. The nature and course of this peculiar experience aroused the suspicion that it resulted from an external toxic influence, and I surmised the connection with the substance with which I had just worked, namely with lysergic acid diethylamide tartrate. However, I could not imagine how I could have absorbed some of this material, since I was accustomed, because of the known toxicity of ergot substances, to meticulously neat work. But possibly a bit of the LSD solution had contacted my fingertips during recrystallization, and a trace of the substance could have come to be absorbed through the skin. In the event that LSD-25 had been the cause of the described incident, then it would have to be a substance of extraordinary potency. With the objective of getting to the bottom of this, I decided to carry out a self-experiment. In order to be cautious, I began the experiment with the smallest quantity with which a definite effect could just barely be expected, namely with 0.25 milligram lysergic acid diethylamide tartrate. The following is a description of this experiment from my laboratory notebook. April 19th, preparation of a 0.05% aqueous solution of lysergic acid diethylamide tartrate. 5 milligrams of air-dried crystalline tartrate was dissolved in 10 cc of water. At 1620, 0.5 cc of the solution containing 0.25 milligram tartrate was taken orally. The solution was completely tasteless, like pure water. At 1650, still no trace of any effect. At 17, slight dizziness, restlessness, unable to concentrate, thoughts, visual distortions, desire to laugh. Here's a note in my laboratory journal, C's. The last words could be written down only with great effort. It was now already clear to me that LSD had been the cause of the remarkable experience of the previous Friday, for all the perceptions were of the same type as before, only much more intense. Only with the greatest difficulty could I still speak intelligibly. I asked my laboratory assistant, who was informed of a self-experiment, to escort me home. On the way home by bicycle, An automobile was not available at the moment during wartime. Automobiles were available only to privileged people in Switzerland. Riding home, my condition began to assume threatening forms. Everything in my field of vision wavered and was distorted as if seen in a curved mirror. I also had the sensation of being unable to move from the spot. Nevertheless, my assistant later told me that we had traveled very rapidly. Finally, however, we arrived at home still safe and sound, and I was just still capable of asking my companion to summon our family doctor and to ask for milk from the neighbor. In spite of my delirious, bewildered condition, I could think clearly and effectively for brief periods. I thought of milk as a non-specific antidote for poisoning. The dizziness and sensation of fainting became so strong at times that I could no longer hold myself erect and had to lay down on the sofa. My surroundings was now transformed in more terrifying ways. Everything in the room spun around, and the familiar objects and pieces of furniture assumed grotesque, mostly threatening forms. They were in continuous motion, animated, as if impregnated by life, by an inner restlessness. The neighbor woman who brought the milk scarcely recognized any longer. She was no longer Mrs. R., but rather a malevolent, insidious witch with a colored mask. Even worse than these demonic transformations of the outer world were the alterations that I perceived in myself, in my inner being. Every exertion of my will to put an end to the disintegration of the outer world and the dissolution of my ego seemed to be wasted effort. A demon had invaded my being, had taken possession of my mind, body and soul. I jumped up and screamed in order to free myself from him, but then sank down again, powerless on the sofa. The substance with which I had wanted to experiment had vanquished me. It was the demon that scornfully triumphed over my will. A dreadful fear grasped me that I was becoming insane. I was taken to another world, another place, another time. My body seemed to be without sensation, lifeless, strange. Was I dying? Was this a transition? At times I believed myself to be outside of my body and then perceived clearly as an outside observer the complete tragedy of my situation. I had not even taken leave of my family. My wife had traveled that day to visit her parents in Lucerne with our three children. Would she ever understand that I had not experimented thoughtlessly, irresponsibly, but rather with utmost caution, and that such a result was in no way foreseeable? My fear and despair intensified not only because a young family should lose its father prematurely, but also because I thought of having to break off unfinished my work as a research chemist, which meant so much for me, in the midst of fruitful, promising development. Also, reflection emerged, full of acrimonious irony, that I was to be compelled now to leave this world behind prematurely through the effort of lysergic acid diethylamide that I had brought forth into this world. As the doctor arrived, the climax of my despairing condition had already passed. My laboratory assistant informed him about my self-experiment, as I myself was not yet able to formulate coherent sentences. We He perplexedly shook his head after I had attempted to refer to my supposed mortally threatened bodily condition, for he could ascertain and no normal symptoms other than an extremely dilated pupils. Pulse, blood pressure and breathing were normal. He therefore prescribed me medicaments. He conveyed me to my bedroom and watched over me on my bed. Slowly again I returned from a weird, unfamiliar world to familiar, everyday reality. The horror softened and gave way to a feeling of fortune and gratitude. Some more normal perceptions and thoughts returned, and my assurance increased that the danger of insanity had conclusively passed, that I would come again to life, because I had really did not know if it ever, as it ever would end, if it was the end. Now I gradually began to enjoy the unprecedented colors and plays of shapes that persisted behind my closed eyes. Kaleidoscopic-like, fantastic images surged in on me, alternating, variegated, opening, and then closing themselves in circles and spirals, exploding in color fountains, rearranging, hybridizing themselves in constant flux. It was particularly remarkable how every acoustic perception, such as the sound of a door handle or a passing automobile, became transformed into optical perceptions. Every sound generated a vividly changing image corresponding in form and color. Late in the evening, my wife returned from Lucerne. Somebody had informed her by telephone that I had sustained a mysterious breakdown. Leaving the children behind her, with her parents, she had traveled home forthwith. I had by now already recovered myself sufficiently that I could relate what had happened. Exhausted, I then slept and woke the next morning refreshed, with a clear head, even though still somewhat tired physically. A sensation of well-being and renewed life flowed through me. Breakfast tasted delicious and was an extraordinary pleasure. When I later walked out into the garden in which the sun now shone after a spring rain, everything glistened and sparkled in fresh light. The world was as if newly created. All my senses vibrated in a condition of highest sensitivity that persisted for the entire day. These had been the first planned experiment with LSD. The first LSD trip, a rather dramatic one. Subsequent experiments on volunteer colleagues of the Sandoz Research Laboratories confirmed the extraordinary activity of LSD on the human psyche. These showed that the effective oral dose of LSD is about 0.05 milligrams. In spite of my caution, I had chosen for the first experiment 5 times the average effective dose. I was aware that LSD, a new active compound with such properties, would have to be of use in pharmacology, in neurology, and especially in psychiatry, and that it would arouse the interest of concerned specialists. But at that time, I could not imagine that the new substance would later also come to be used beyond medical science in the drug scene as an intoxicant. Since in my first self-experiment, I had experienced LSD in its terrifying demonism. I could not imagine that this substance could be ever used, so to speak, as a pleasure drug. Also, the meaningful connection between LSD experience and spontaneous visionary experience I recognized only later after further experiments. which were carried out with lower doses and with a different set and setting. That is the story of the discovery of LSD in some shortened fashion.